Did you ever hear of a stranded renewable? That's the idea of a renewable energy source that is not located where it's consumed. And guess what? That's kind of common here in Alaska. So what do we do about it? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Call 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. Let's think big about our energy options and get some ideas on the table on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, here we are back on the subject of energy, and we'll be back returning to it again next month. It's kind of like the food security issue. We can't get off of it. People want to talk about it, and plus it affects your pocketbook. That's serious business. So every time we've discussed energy virtually, a caller calls up and says, we need to be thinking bigger. How about putting a wind farm out in the Aleutians and producing hydrogen? I said, well, how about it? Maybe we should talk about it on some show. Well, this is the one. This is the show. It seems that thinking big about energy has kind of always been around. I remember not long after I came to Alaska that some people associated with Wally Hickel were speaking with colleagues over in Russia about putting a power line across the Bering Strait in some way. They said if they could accomplish this, the whole world's electrical grid would become one grid, and somehow there would be efficiencies in this. And that's kind of a vision I think I heard repeatedly from Wally Hickel. And I think it's still alive somewhere at the Institute of the North. Then we had the Rampart Dam. When did that one come up? Maybe in the 1940s? This is the idea of damming the entire Yukon River to generate hydropower. That one ran into some opposition. It didn't happen, but what happened is that the idea was scaled down and applied to the Susitna River. And there was endless planning then for a Susitna Dam, which would generate far more power than all of Alaska needed. But the idea would be, if you build it, they will come and locate their industry. Well, that one died because of the cost, because it finally was revealed that Alaska didn't have the assets to secure the debt load without putting the permanent fund at risk. And it died that day. I remember distinctly that day it died. All he had to do was say permanent fund and it was gone. But lo and behold, now we have the Watana Dam. In other words, these ideas that are real and actually get enacted, get engineered, get feasibility studied, often will start as the big ideas. And once the engineers get hold of them and they start looking at all the details, they tend to get scaled down and eventually something gets built. Meanwhile, a bunch of stuff gets tested. So this is the session where we try and look at the big ideas and how they can be scaled down and made practical. We've got other ones, like, for instance, tapping a volcano, or the aforementioned wind farm producing hydrogen and now ammonia, or biomass options, and we'll be hearing more about that later in the program. But there's the idea of getting a pellet plant finally in Alaska as a fuel source, and then there's just the matter of using wind energy and finding a better way to store it. And often it does boil down to storage. When you're talking a stranded renewable, it almost has to. I want to welcome Bill Leedy to the program. Bill is in Juneau. I don't even know how to introduce you, Bill, but you're going to be making a pitch to the Southeast Conference in a little bit. And you certainly have a technical and engineering background. An inventing background, and your entire family does. So maybe you can give me some idea of what you're going to try to interest the Southeast Conference there in Juneau.
Steve, I don't have a role at the Southeast Conference meeting today. It's their mid-session roundup, I guess they call it. I've been on the Renewable Energy Cluster Working Group, sponsored by U.S. Forest Service via Juneau Economic Development Council. That's been about a year-long process, coming up with ideas for how a cluster of renewable energy companies, private enterprises, could be induced, enticed to form here in Southeast Alaska. So I've been co-authoring research papers in the larger context for over 10 years on the problem of how are we going to run the world on renewables, which we must do sooner or later. The sooner the better, because the fossil fuels that we're using now are putting too much CO2 in the atmosphere with the consequences that we see here in Alaska. So you mentioned hydrogen and ammonia, the other hydrogen, NH3, anhydrous ammonia, is the only other fuel that we have that's carbon-free. Both of these can be made from renewable source electricity, which leads to one of the problems that we always have in discussing energy, that we confuse the language, the terms, power, energy, electricity, firm energy, dispatchable energy, and wind farms and windmills. And so we really need to get our language straight before we can have an unambiguous conversation about this.
Yeah, well, let's throw in potential energy and kinetic, because all you have to do, for instance, is feel the pipe at pump one and realize that oil down in the ground is cold by the time, but the pressure working on it means that when it comes up to the surface, it's going to be hot. Potential energy. Same thing, of course, happening with hydro. Okay, go ahead, Bill.
So in Southeast Alaska, where the Integrated Resource Plan, the first ever done, is now being debated in the adjoining room, the consultant, Black & Veatch, a well-known international consultant, has concluded that because the Southeast energy market, and here we're confusing energy and electricity, because an integrated resource plan is typically focused on the electricity industry, and electricity is only about a third of the energy that we use, because our market's so small here, these expensive transmission projects to try to bring stranded renewable energy, we have a lot of hydropower, tidal, several kinds of renewable energy here, to markets, is going to be too expensive. Even if somebody built the transmission systems, we, the users, couldn't afford to own, operate, and maintain them, because the amount of energy sent over those transmission systems would be so small, unless we were to export it. Now, how are we going to export energy to the rest of the continent or to the Pacific Rim with electric transmission lines? It's really a daunting prospect, and that brings up the possibility of converting that renewable source electricity right at the wind plant or the hydro plant or the solar plant, in the case of the desert areas, to a fuel and shipping it in pipelines, or in the case of anhydrous ammonia, in liquid tankers, which is now done all over the world. Anhydrous ammonia is the second most used industrial chemical in the world.
But I thought it was a fertilizer.
It is. That's our primary use for it. But it's also a fuel. The internal combustion engine, combustion turbine, and fuel cell will all run on it very well.
I don't think. Now, I don't have a car, but if I did have a car, I don't think I could take a bottle of ammonia and put it in my gas tank.
No. You could modify the vehicle so that the gas tank becomes an ammonia tank. You have either direct liquid injection or air induction induction of ammonia into the engine, where it burns like any other fossil fuel. Like any fossil fuel would, ammonia is not a fossil fuel. If we make it from renewable sources, it has no carbon.
So you were proposing then that we find a liquid storage method, as opposed to what's usually talked about. How in the world do we we have ways we can generate power, but then how do we store it? I mean, you even get this with a windmill, because the windmill is going to generate when the wind is blowing, but that's not necessarily when you've got the load. And so we've
that's right. Yeah. All over the world, the storage problem is now becoming now getting much more attention than it had been before as we increase the penetration, as they say, of renewables on an electricity system. It begins to upset the stability of the system, and we have the seasonal problem. It's not very windy in the Great Plains in August when you need a lot of electricity to run your air conditioners. So how can we afford to store energy at annual firming scale, months worth of energy? You can't do it in batteries, flywheels, compressed air, pumped hydro storage, the methods that are used now for storing energy for short periods of time. And that's where liquid anhydrous ammonia probably is our best choice.
So what are we going to do? Where do we start engineering something like this to see it to see it actually work?
Well, the state's Emerging Energy Technology Fund, which is now just getting off the ground, they closed application acceptance on Monday, I think.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was going to have a guest. I was going to have a guest, an expert in here from that outfit, but he couldn't be here because he's reviewing applications. So I know this is active.
Right. Well, our small company, Alaska Applied Sciences, Inc., has applied for one of those grants to move a new ammonia synthesis method called solid-state ammonia synthesis from a laboratory curiosity to a proof-of-concept pilot plant. If that is successful, technically and economically, it could be the way by which we in Alaska and elsewhere in the world convert renewable source electricity into anhydrous ammonia, which then can be stored at very low cost in large or small common steel storage tanks. It's much like propane for storage purposes.
Well, somehow I always heard hydrogen. Now I'm hearing ammonia. It's kind of throwing me for
hydrogen,
a loop.
Well, hydrogen might be very attractive in the lower 48, where we have very long transmission distances, very large markets, and access to the low-cost storage medium for hydrogen, which is domal salt deposits along the Gulf of Mexico coast. There, you can hydraulically mine, that is, dissolve a large cavern out of a large subterranean salt deposit, creating a very large storage cavern for everything from natural gas and liquid hydrocarbons to hydrogen. There are two such hydrogen storage caverns there now. So imagine the lower 48 has an interconnected system of renewable source generation, wind plants in the Great Plains and solar plants in the deserts, all connected by hydrogen pipelines with the storage in hundreds or thousands of these solution mine salt caverns in the domal salt along the Gulf of Mexico coast. There's enough renewable source energy to run the whole country, not just electricity, but all the energy demand of the whole country. And it could be done entirely by hydrogen, which we then ship to our homes and factories to use for combined heat and power, generate electricity on site, use the byproduct heat for heating and cooling the buildings, and for transportation fuel.
Wow.
But in Alaska, our market, again, is so small that scheme is probably technically and economically inferior to using anhydrous ammonia.
Well, Bill, you're thinking big. I'm joined here by Brian Hirsch of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. He is the senior project leader for the Department of Energy's Alaska National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Alaska. Brian, welcome to Talk of Alaska, and what do you make of Bill Leedy's idea?
Well, thank you, Steve. I guess there's a couple, just I want to put some context on the whole situation here. This concept of hydrogen is this classic, it's just down the road a little bit, maybe 5 years away, and everything will be fine. And it's been like that for 20 or more years, for as long as I've been in the energy industry. And just to define it a little bit, hydrogen is essentially, you could look at it just like a battery. It really is a storage vehicle. And so hydrogen isn't a primary fuel that you're going to be pulling out of the earth initially. You're making hydrogen from, say, wind power or solar power or whatever it is, hydropower. Those are the original prime movers that give us the energy. And in general, people think about, oh, we have an energy crisis kind of thing. And what we really have is a challenge around capturing, converting, and concentrating energy. There's a lot of it out there, whether it's water moving in the ocean or winds blowing in the air, etc., or sun shining down on us. But the challenges and what we're really looking at are this idea of sort of gathering that and making it usable energy for our concentrated lifestyles and when using it when we want it. So what hydrogen theoretically allows one to do is to capture that and make it useful. And yet there are some real physical challenges with hydrogen, and what Bill is talking about here, Bill Leedy, around ammonia is essentially making hydrogen more user-friendly, because the energy component of ammonia really is the hydrogen. You're ultimately going to be using the hydrogen. Anhydrous ammonia is NH3. So there are three molecules of hydrogen in every, or atoms of hydrogen in every molecule of ammonia. So that's really what the business end of ammonia is, the hydrogen component of it. And so it's just a more user-friendly way to store it, to transport it, and to concentrate it. And I think Bill is right on the cutting edge and doing something really exciting. And I think it's something that could put Alaska in the forefront. There's a lot of questions and concerns and unknowns at this stage, but without moving forward on those, they'll continue to be just big question marks.
Bill Leedy, if you want to add anything more, I want to thank you for thinking big for Talk of Alaska and for all the people of Alaska here.
Steve, Brian makes a very important point. We should be thinking about complete energy systems, from the renewable sources, which is moving air and water molecules and photons from the sun, to energy services delivered. Nobody wants a kilowatt hour. Nobody wants a gallon of gasoline. We want the energy services that these energy carriers and storage media provide us. So as we contemplate our energy future, eventually running the world on renewables, which we have to do one way or the other, this shale gale, we've got 100 years of natural gas, which apparently is diverting people's attention, means that we got to get working right now because we only have 100 years of natural gas. We'll need to run the world on renewables. So we need to think in that context. How are we going to run all of human activities on renewable source energy gathered from moving air and water molecules and photons from the sun and some geothermal as well? How are we going to do that as complete energy systems optimized technically and economically?
All right. Thanks a lot, Bill Leedy, for joining us. I'll let you get back to your meeting there.
Great. Thanks a lot, Steve.
All right, Brian. We'll be checking back.
We'll be checking back
with Bill Leedy at some point in the future, I have the feeling. So Brian, you're actually involved with this Emerging Energy Technology Fund, right?
Yes, I'm the statewide chair of the advisory committee, and so there's a staffed structure that is done through the Alaska Energy Authority, a state energy office. And then they have a sort of a panel of experts that advises them and assists in reviewing some of these grant applications, which was mentioned a little bit earlier. It was due, I believe, on March 9th. And so now we have substantial amounts of grant review. And so some people do the first round, and then I get to do the second round. So that's why I could show up here today instead of the person you were mentioning earlier who wasn't able to be here.
All right. Well, it's just very, I mean, everybody's very busy. Everybody I contacted, it's just like a complete goat rope trying to book a talk show, because everybody's busy talking to one another and doing this or that or the other. And I appreciate you coming in, because, of course, you're going to be reviewing proposals. And now, of course, we'll be hearing from the proposers.
That's right. Well, I was struck by the very beginning of this radio show here. The underwriting comment was from one of the local oil companies that mentioned all the easy oil is now already discovered, and now it's the hard stuff that's left. And that's really what we're finding, both with fossil fuels as well as some of the renewables. We're still earlier in the curve with renewables, where there's a lot of relatively low-hanging fruit out there. But along the lines of what Bill was talking about just a moment ago, if we're really going to scale up the amount of renewable contribution to our energy budget, which is substantial. Right now, renewables contribute about 10 or 12% nationally of the total energy budget, and U.S. citizens are among the largest consumers of energy in the world, and Alaskans are among the highest within the U.S. hierarchy. So we're really at the very top of the food chain here. And if we are ultimately going to transition, whether it's for cost or pollution, whether you look at it from not just carbon, but from other historically quote-unquote dirty byproducts of fossil fuel combustion that are challenging us with the productive systems of the planet, then even if you don't look at climate change and carbon, and you look at the other negative byproducts of fossil fuels, there are some real challenges that one would think you want to try to address and get ahead of that curve. And so looking at these big renewable potentials are both the challenge and really exciting, and it's a long-term prospect. So there are big ideas out there. Many of them need some reality check. I think this is a good approach to the show here, because there are all sorts of ideas, and there is a lot of confusion out there, I think, between the types of energy and just the ease of using them. For example, something like, say, geothermal, where if you can develop that, it's an energy source that's always there, and you have both heat and you have power, which is electricity.
Well, yeah, and last time I had you on the show, we were talking about the turbines, which of course you were involved with the Ruby.
That's right,
turbine. There's a great gap between trying to use the energy of this moving water and the practicalities of the machinery that and how it's engineered, how it's moored, how you keep the silt and stuff from getting into it. What about when the wood comes down the river and the ice and so forth?
Sure, and of course with something like that in Alaska, the water's moving in the summer when we have less need for
right.
as much energy and heat as we do in the wintertime. So we don't have a whole lot of moving water in the winter. So those are the kinds of issues that Bill was talking about earlier with firming and seasonal storage, which isn't just for 5 minutes or even an hour. It's really on the month or seasonal type situation,
yeah,
which are much more
really,
challenging.
That really stuck in my mind. We're joined now by Mira Kohler, who's CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. And I proposed this to, I put the idea out on the web, and Mira came back and says, I got a thinking big idea. And so I said, well, call us up and tell us about it then. Mira, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve. Happy to be here.
Well, so you were telling me that you're thinking about stranded gas and how to unstrand it.
I think that we need to find solutions in the near term. And what's wrong with conventional technology that's tried and tested that we can build ourselves? We don't need to import manpower. We can build a gas generating station up on the North Slope. We can build a transmission system. We can connect virtually all of Alaska, excluding Southeast Alaska, and supply all of our needs until these hydrogen scenarios perhaps become reality, and do it for a fraction of the cost of other proposals that are floating around today.
So you're saying a power line instead of a gas line, essentially?
I'm saying that it's a heck of a lot easier to transfer the electrons than it is to transfer the gas.
Wow. I haven't seen that penciled out or anything. Are you putting this forward as a proposal or just some dream?
Well, you know, it's a dream that is grounded in reality. We're looking at, right now, there are regional plans being developed under the aegis of the Energy Authority, who's funding these, and every region is battling with solutions for their own regions. And those solutions are relatively modest. They're not only modest, but they're extremely expensive. Well, building a hydro project, for example, in a preserve, a national reserve, is probably not going to get very far and is going to cost a lot of money. We're talking right now about building, and in fact the AEA is heading this up, building the Susitna project, the Watana Dam. Their initial cost estimate in today's dollars, I believe, is $4.5 billion, and that does not include access to the project nor the transmission lines that are going to have to be built to move the power, because the existing transmission system isn't able to carry it. So I would say to you that you can build a project that is 10 times the size of the Watana project up on the North Slope, using stranded natural gas up at the North Slope for the same money as you could build the Susitna project. And then you could build a high-voltage transmission line to pipe that power down to Fairbanks and on to Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula, and you could do that for a fraction of the cost of what we're looking at for other projects. And the charming aspect to this, to me, is that you can convert all the heat source, which is currently basically diesel fuel or wood or natural gas in the Anchorage area, which is at risk right now for running out, and you could convert that all to electricity and fire that with natural gas. It is so practical that it jumps up and bites you in the ankle, but if nobody's working on it, I do plan to get folks working on it. I know there's some well-known players in the energy industry that are willing to sit down and chalk it out and then put together a plan to do it. And it could be done in a reasonable time frame.
What do you think, Brian Hirsch?
I think there actually has been some proposals along those lines, and there is even some major multinational companies that do work in Alaska that are involved in looking at that. And there are a lot of trade-offs, and I mean, I would definitely support what Mira is saying in the general sense of we do need solutions here and now, and I just don't want to give anybody the misimpression that I'm off in some laboratory looking at hydrogen all the time, because most of my focus is on the practical and the here and now. And yet, of course, you just asked for us to kind of look at the big picture, and
indeed,
that does take some longer term thinking and a perspective. But what Mira's saying is definitely one of the many options that are out there. And really what I see happening in Alaska right now is we're starving amidst plenty. We have almost too many options. And I think that the North Slope direct conversion to electricity and moving the power down is definitely something that ought to be considered on a feasibility level and really get down to nuts and bolts and see. I think it will take some time. I think there is a lot of transmission upgrades that would be required. There are a lot of moving parts to it, and it will take a few years, but it's definitely among the potentially feasible prospects.
Mira, are you picturing the power line actually feeding then to getting the grid to some villages, perhaps?
I definitely think that is in the picture. What I see is a high voltage, probably a direct current line, like mm-hmm. they have in Texas, where they move large amounts of power across the state, going from the North Slope to Fairbanks as an express feeder, more or less, branching off from there at one or two points, potentially heading west to get to the Kotzebue region, potentially to the Bethel region, to the Nome region. And then the same thing, you have another express feeder that's going from Fairbanks to Anchorage in the peninsula that's going to be able to transport that power down to that region and then branch off from there. I see the backbone branch being built and then the connecting branches built to that, and all being built more or less at the same time. If it's properly coordinated, I think that this is achievable within 10 years.
Wow. 10 years.
I think it's a much more practical 10 years than, for example, Watana, for example, the earliest turn on the switch date is 2023. So, and that's a highly optimistic date. So I think that a natural gas and transmission option has a much more closer potential.
All right, Mira, thank you.
What I was going to offer here is just, again, a little bit of background or context, which this term stranded renewables, for example, the idea and the term itself actually has come from really both the electric utility industry and the fossil fuel industry. If you recall, several years ago within Alaska, we had something called the Alaska Stranded Gas Act. And the concept was the same idea, which is that gas was on the North Slope and we couldn't figure out a way to access it economically. And within the electric utility industry, similarly, if there is an investment in a resource that ultimately isn't used effectively, you can't include that in your what they call your base rate for determining what you charge customers on their monthly bills. So it's called a stranded asset because you can't generate a return on it. And so this idea within the renewable setting is even more challenging. It's the same idea, but because something like, say, large-scale wind out in the Aleutians, wind is not a very reliable resource. It's clean. There's lots of really great benefits to wind, but it's not reliable. You can't predict when it's going to show up, and it's not very concentrated. So you need these big wind turbines to concentrate and collect that wind and then convert it to something usable, whether it's electricity or maybe ultimately into some storage medium such as hydrogen or ammonia, what have you. So there are many steps to get it to the point where, again, we can use it. But so because it's just flowing out there and nobody's taking advantage of it, quote unquote, that's the idea behind the stranded piece of it. And so with within the fossil fuel industry in particular, stranded gas has really helped define this conversation. And what we have right now on the North Slope is the classic stranded gas resource. And we are trying to figure out how to convert that into something that can be used. And I think we have the same challenges of markets and remoteness and cost for building a transmission line to Kotzebue is pretty pricey from the North Slope via Fairbanks, certainly.
Mira Kohler.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for thinking big for us on Talk of Alaska.
Well, it's not just a pleasure, it's a life-saving measure, in my opinion. Alaska, as Brian mentioned, in the land of plenty, we are strangling. When you look at the present-day value of the dollars that are being spent on energy in this state, you quickly start to realize that there is money being burned that could be put to good use in building some assets that are going to serve us well into the future.
All right. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We're talking about thinking big. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. And they're all humming away as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
We're talking about stranded renewable, big energy ideas on Talk of Alaska today. We got a panoply of guests, and this in the email from Mark Masteller, who says the big idea needs to be using these energy supplies in the following order. First, conservation. Second, efficiency. Third, local and widely distributed, relatively small-scale energy production from renewables. He says, with the first two, conservation and efficiency, we can reduce demand by 80%, allowing the use of renewables for the energy we need to produce. So look at energy conservation efficiency as a source of energy first. And I'm going to send it just flying into the stratosphere. Connected by telephone is Professor Johannes Lehmann, Professor of Crop and Soil Sciences at the Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future at Cornell University. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Johannes.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
What's the weather like in Ithaca?
Yeah, we skipped out completely on the winter, so the daffodils are blooming already. Very weird.
Johannes, I brought you onto the program because you have this idea, and actually I think it's been going on for a while, about biochar and carbon sequestration and how things might be engineered to localize, I guess you would say, some of these practices. And so I thought I'd first ask you to give me kind of an introduction as to what is biochar and why.
Yeah, that's a good question. Both what and why. I got interested in biochar about 10, 15 years ago when I researched certain fertile soils in the central Amazon in Brazil. And it turned out that these soils in an otherwise very infertile soilscape were fertile for a long period of time and were manipulated by pre-Columbian Indians. And the secret of what makes these soils tick are additions of charcoal or what we now call biochar in the context of a soil amendment. So biochar is a charcoal-like substance that in soil may dramatically improve soil fertility and stays in the soil for very long periods of time, much, much longer than a crop residue or leaf that falls from the tree. So, and about 10 years ago, the community of soil scientists and environmentalists got together with engineers that were interested in bioenergy production. And it turns out that there is a bioenergy pathway that uses biomass and smolders it in a process that is called scientifically pyrolysis. So that's very similar to charcoal making, with the difference that in that process, the engineers were particularly interested in the gases and the liquids that come off in the smoke while making charcoal, whereas traditionally charcoal makers were, of course, interested in the solid product, the charcoal, and couldn't care less about the smoke. In fact, it was very harmful to their lungs. So those two communities met about 10 years ago and said, hey, we have something in common, this process of charcoal making. You are interested in the energy that comes out of this in form of the gases and the liquids, and we are interested in the charcoal product because we can put it to soil where the carbon stays for a very long period of time and improves dramatically soil properties and soil health for productivity.
So all that's left is the engineering.
Now is and that's of course always and only in quotation marks. Although making charcoal is one of the oldest, maybe can claim to be the oldest industrial technology that humanity developed very long ago in the Iron Age to make pig iron. And has been used up to today in pig iron production. In Brazil is a very large producer of charcoal. So in principle, we would think that we have the technology down. But it turns out that in many of the production sites, we're using very ancient technology to produce charcoal and producing liquid fuels and gaseous fuels and electricity from the gases is something that has lagged behind other developments in the bioenergy sector for quite a while.
I'm going to go to our callers here, which we have stacked up in a huge number because we seem to have broached a bunch of provocative areas of discussion here, Johannes. But I, if you could stay with us, I would appreciate it, and you can kind of leave at your will. But because I know you've got a schedule to keep up there at Cornell. But one thing that you said that really struck me at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, where you were speaking about the on a panel that was talking about how do we get to 350 part per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, is you said there's no such thing as humus. You said we have to think about a deeper level. We have to think about our soil on a deeper level and the chemical surfaces involved. And the potential, you said, for sequestering carbon in soils is enormous if we think about it in a different way. And that's part of what, biochar does and some other things too. But just to keep this in perspective, it's a huge perspective. Speaking with the forestry people, there was initially the idea that, oh, well, all we have to do is keep planting trees and we can absorb the carbon dioxide out of the air. Well, that works. You keep adding trees and you do keep sequestering more carbon, but it tops out. And then the trees get under stress and they're actually starting to even lose some CO2. But with what you're talking about, adding this biochar into the soil, this is more of a long-term sequestration process, right?
Absolutely, yes. And granted, it will depend on what kind of biochar produce, but I think the scientific community is at a stage where we slowly are developing the insight and the methodology to identify those chars that have a very long lifespan. And what is very important is that if that goes hand in hand with soil improvement, because we can stash away carbon somewhere, we can bury whole logs, we can grow trees and make a big hole and fill the trees in that hole, and that has been proposed, and that's a very cost-effective way of sequestering carbon, maybe even more cost-effective than biochar, but I like to think about technologies that don't just stash away carbon in geological strata or in big holes, but make use of it. It's photosynthetically fixed carbon biomass is a rare resource, and photosynthesis is an energy-intensive process. We might as well use the biomass that would otherwise be mineralized to CO2 and returned back to the atmosphere to a much greater extent for environmental management.
With us also is Brian Hirsch of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory.
Thanks, Brian, Steve. I just wanted to integrate the last two comments, both with your guest and the email comment you read, which is absolutely, from the energy perspective, conservation, which is making do with less, efficiency, which is doing it better. And then before you even get to renewables, arguably, this idea that your current guest from Cornell is talking about, which is really the way I see it, is sort of an energy integration that looks at the energy, food, and water nexus. Because really what we're talking about here, again, we don't want energy for the sake of energy. We want it to provide light when it's dark or be able to communicate electronically across many miles of distance, et cetera. So really we're talking about services making our lives better. And so at some point, the idea here is that energy is only a piece of that. And if we run out of water, we run out of air, we run out of food, then those are equal problems to running out of energy. And so this concept of biochar and integrating, right now the common industrial wisdom is it takes 10 calories of primarily fossil fuel energy to make 1 calorie of food that we consume. And if you play that out over the long term and over the whole world, that's not a very sustainable equation. And so the idea of amending our soils and sequestering carbon at the same time and improving the fertility of the soils is absolutely a huge piece of how we provide for ourselves. And it will ultimately result, hopefully, in reduced energy use and consumption to meet our other needs.
Johannes, you probably have thought about some steps from where we are now on biomass, which essentially is either burning wood or taking crops and turning them into alcohol, to this more integrated process you're talking about. What kind of, can you give me a step or two in between those two things?
I think one has to be looking, and I think that rang also in your previous conversations. You have to look at the local opportunities and constraints. It sounds so trite, and we repeat ourselves in saying that in almost all sectors and discussions, there's no one-size-fits-all and no silver bullet. So we have to look at the local opportunities, and there are very good examples where making biochar and fuels through pyrolysis might be a very good idea. And one is, for instance, dealing with the pine bark beetle kill in British Columbia and other places in the West that are currently mostly burned. One could use this material to pyrolyze it and at least get biochar out, maybe even feed electricity in a grid if that's possible. But those are local opportunities. The question is of scaling this up to anything that makes a difference to our carbon budget. And that is so difficult to say that we retreat typically behind vocabulary such as a technical potential or this maximum sustainable potential. And what that does is typically only to probe what if we did this on a large scale, what could this achieve, and is it worth thinking more about it as a wider strategy? But I think I would like to be at a stage where we can implement it where it is where it delivers sustainability and see how the economics pan out, improve the engineering and the technology, do an impact assessment, an environmental impact assessment, and then move forward.
Thank you very much, Professor Johannes Lehmann at Cornell University. We got a comment from Bruce. He says, hey, I'm already doing it in my garden. It works. Roberta joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Roberta.
Good morning.
Morning.
And so wonderful to hear Brian's voice. And Don Young liked this idea, never went anywhere, was lower the speed limit to 55. This would save immense amounts of oil and would save lives. The second idea Lisa Murkowski liked and never went anywhere with it was turn off all unnecessary lights nationwide, what the heck, why not worldwide, would save immense amounts of energy. And these are here and now ideas, and of course the power companies and the oil companies and gas companies aren't going to get rich off of this, so they would be the ones that we'd have to probably battle. I like all the other ideas that are coming along, but this one is the quickest and simplest, and I'll just leave you with a quote. We must protect the forests for our children, grandchildren, and children yet to be born. We must protect the forests for those who can't speak for themselves, such as the birds, animals, fish, and trees. Respect all life and harmony and balance between the environment and the economy, and thank you so much.
Roberta, thank you so much for your call from Homer. With a closing thought, let's go to Matthew in Willow. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Matthew.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just would really like to hear more about the proposed geothermal at Mount Spur or any of the other of our hot spots that we've got around the state, which are many.
And nowadays we're even talking about warm spots, you know. But one of the people I thought about having on the show was Bernie Carl. But I think that's a whole other show.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, let's see what Brian knows about Mount Spur.
Sure.
All right.
Yeah, thank you. So in general, Alaska has substantial geothermal resource. A lot of it we don't really even know how big it is and how easy it is to take advantage of. If you look at a place like, say, Iceland, for example, which is probably the best known geothermal country developing their resources, they have a different type of geothermal resource. It's called a rift source as compared to a subduction source, which is what we have, the plates kind of banging into each other.
It's not near so explosive, but it does explode, we found out.
Yeah. And so basically the upshot of that is that our geothermal resource is more challenging and hence costly to produce. And in some cases, it may not pan out as well as it looks on paper in terms of, oh, geez, we have a lot of volcanoes and hot spots out there. But Mount Spur in particular, my understanding is that this summer they will be back up here again, the company that has the resource development rights, and they will be drilling once again, looking for basically, again, a user-friendly or least costly location and situation to make that useful energy for the Anchorage and Rail Belt region. Last summer, my understanding is that it was fairly disappointing in what they found. And
glad you're being so frank about that.
It's not by any stretch a done deal or anything else. They're absolutely still optimistic and coming back this summer, et cetera, but they didn't quite find what they had hoped to find, at least on first blush. But I'd offer, even for example, you think about way back drilling in Prudhoe Bay, they'd been looking for 10 years and they were literally on their last well and they were ready to pack up the bags and they found, you know, what's become 15 billion barrels of oil. So it's not like there's never a chance that just the first chance, sometimes you don't find it, obviously. So they're continuing to look, and the state has been very supportive. And the company Ormat is the largest geothermal company in the world and very innovative and has projects throughout the globe. And they, I think, are still pretty excited about the Alaska prospects. So
Matthew, if they can't do it, nobody can.
That might
there
be the case.
Well, and we can't forget about those warm spots, too, because here in Willow, there's at least around 19 or so households with geothermal heat pump systems.
Yeah.
So it's definitely viable in many spots. And so thank you, guys, and I appreciate the show.
All right, Matthew, thank you for your call as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center with three locations, including its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, and digital X-rays to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com. First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
So we're getting some email. This one from Tom, and kind of responding to Mira Kohler's idea of a power line, gas-fired turbines on the North Slope, a power line getting down to where the population is. He says, well, if the state uses the gas it owns like it would use the water it owns at a dam, it would greatly decrease the cost, point one. Point two, with cheap electricity on the slope, if a redundant fiber optic system was installed, we could attract server farms to use the year-round cold weather for cheap cooling. And I guess I would throw into that, Brian Hirsch, that one of the things, there was a conference on stranded renewable energy, and one of the things that started coming up is maybe you need to start thinking about siting things where the energy is.
That's exactly right. And I was involved just recently in a research paper that is about to be published, and it's with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Alaska Center for Energy and Power, looking specifically at stranded renewables in Alaska. And one of the very interesting outcomes of the research was this, what we're calling place-based industry. So instead of ultimately capturing, converting this dispersed energy and figuring out a way to ship it out, whether it's via power line or anhydrous ammonia or whatever it would be. Instead, you could consider bringing industries that use the energy to the location of where you're concentrating and converting it. And one of the advantages that we found in a cold weather place like Alaska is server farms, such as, say, what Google's doing or some of the other large computer companies, because their single largest energy cost is for cooling. So if we can provide a cheap, reliable power that's clean, because a lot of these server farm companies are really focused on sort of the clean, green, high-tech industries. So if we can provide clean energy, reliable energy, low-cost energy, and a reduction just from the pure environmental side of cooling needs, then we are ahead of the game. And so the other piece that is obviously very necessary that we don't have the natural advantage of is the data connection, the high-speed fiber optics, et cetera. So that would be a piece of the big equation that's absolutely essential and that would probably require some sort of investment, whether it's government, private sector, some combination of both, et cetera. But that's the other necessary ingredient for a successful server farm, obviously.
Wow, and being more cyber-connected would be attractive to many Alaskans.
Absolutely.
Bob Gillum made billions off of that, off of better connectivity and his stock trading system already. And I'm also reminded of Tony Smith and Steve Cooper's scheme of making us into the Swiss bank of the world, you know, making a center of financial services all the way up here in Alaska.
Well, when you look at Alaska, say, circumpolarly or just throughout the whole world, the classic circumpolar look of the map from the top, Alaska is essentially equidistant from the east coast of the U.S. and Asia in terms of markets in Beijing and all over China, Japan, et cetera. Europe, if you go over the top across by Fairbanks and over that way. So from some perspectives, while we're very remote, in other ways, we have a unique natural advantage of being equidistant from all of these places and arguably closer than some other locations would be. So that's why for example, our air cargo market is as active as it is. And if you needed a physical link, even though we see it as cyber and sort of virtual, the reality is that there are physical data links that are fiber optic cables and things along those lines connecting the different parts of the world. And so in that way, we arguably do have a natural advantage that we could be taking more advantage of.
Thinking big about energy, the subject on Talk of Alaska. Marvin joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Marvin.
Hey, thank you, Steve. Great program and great discussion today.
Well, all right.
Yeah, I just wanted to introduce the idea of these hydrogen production stations and hydrogen storage solutions and the hydrogen power solutions that Votek Labs has introduced to the Department of Defense. And it's getting really great draw reviews and everything, and I think it would be an ideal product for Alaska.
And this would be more like the kind of the smaller scale hydrogen you're talking about?
Absolutely, yeah. They're scalable. These hydrogen production stations, they could, you know, generate about 30,000 liters of hydrogen an hour on, you know, 60, 70 kilowatts of electricity, generating from either a solar, wind generator, you know, hydro, whatever alternative energy product that would be out there. And, you know, for that type of production, you know, you could easily heat 100 homes a year. So I think it's a solution for rural Alaska, and I think it's something that should be really looked at. And we've been working at it for about a year now, introducing the product into Alaska.
Well, good.
Yeah.
So you got a proposal for the Emerging Energy Technology Fund yet?
Yeah, we went down and submitted one last year, but apparently their regulation process wasn't complete and it got delayed. But we've since moved on, and Department of Defense had picked up and are looking at deploying this overseas.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because there actually is this, people in the energy business know, there's this military mandate where they have to go to more renewables. So they're kind of looking, they're shopping.
Yeah, yeah. We went down into Res here last week in Las Vegas, and it was a big Indian energy or economic conference in Las Vegas. And Department of Energy folks were down there, and they came to our booth. We had a hydrogen heater. We had a hydrogen generator, and we also had a hydrogen fuel cell.
And nothing blew up like the Hindenburg.
No, that's old school. In fact, that's probably one of the biggest barriers we've been having.
I know.
Convincing these scientists that there's been a major breakthrough in hydrogen in the last year or so. Evonix is a major player in hydrogen storage solutions, and you know they've come a long, long way. We can get hydrogen in an aluminum canister now, with less than 200 pounds of pressure.
Marvin, I want to thank you for joining us on the program here. Johannes Lehmann, if you're still with us?
I am.
All right. I want to thank you for being willing to be in your office so we could talk to you out at Cornell.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I'll be checking back with you in the future. Brian Hirsch, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for the invitation.
Everybody else that joined the program and all the callers and emailers, it's been a lot of fun. We're going to get back to this energy subject in a couple of weeks. I want to thank Josh Edge and Dave, and we'll be back. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by The Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at AlaskaPublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.